This one.
You see? You're seeing the good things. Well, I do all the time.
Maria?
I do eat all good things.
It's not very much, very often. Not very much of it. Okay. So this is, again, Surah 2. Oh, sorry. So may we have a reader for this?
Yep, my husband.
Okay.
You who believe, eat of the good things that we have provided you, and give thanks to God if it is He whom you worship. He has forbidden you dead things, al-maita, the blood, al-dam, and the flesh of pigs, laham al-khanzir, and what has been offered up to other than God. But if one is compelled without desiring or deliberately returning to pre-Islamic transgression, then no sin accrues to him, for God is forgiving, compassionate.
Okay, so if you're forced to eat chazer, there's no problem.
Absolutely.
Or if you didn't really want to do it yourself.
Or if you're starving to death and you need to eat chazer, then there's no problem.
Yeah, that's also
the force of custom.
Is there an image of God as like a bean counter? You know, you did this, you get 1 point, you did that, you get 1 point off, you did that, minus two, and then...
Like, that's the book of...
I don't know. I'm sure in the anal compulsive movements, then I would assume that that might be the case, like as in our anal compulsive tendencies. But I don't think that's the image in the kind of normative Islam. There's a really nice image of God and responsibility in kind of mainstream normative Islam, and that is we Muslims do the best we can, and we really can't start ragging on our Muslim compatriots because we really don't know what they're really doing. In other words, you should not... There's no... mitzvah police. They're not supposed to be. There are. I mean, look at Saudi Arabia, look at Iran today. There really are mitzvah police. But that's not normative. The normative Islam is everyone will be brought before God at some point, and God will tell you whether you did a good job or you didn't do a good job. And it's between you and God, ultimately. So you shouldn't be making criticisms of other people's lives, because you don't really know what's going on with their lives. It's a little bit like the kind of repeated Hasidic rabbi stories where they do something that looks like it's a thank you. Well, actually, I have this. You know, I just do it in this one. The Hasidic rabbi story where, you know, the rabbi looks like he's breaking all the rules, and in fact what he's really doing is something more important than that. That is very much a part of the normative view in the Muslim world that I'm familiar with. Now, granted, I hang out with nice people and people who are interested in dialogue and people who are kind of moderate and involved, and that's how I understand, and that's what I've read. It's a nice deal. I can't imagine that that's the way it is in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, they have the mitzvah, what do you call it, the something police, they call it the moral police or whatever, who's running after you because you're...
Moral brigade or something.
Yeah, your dress is not long enough or you're showing skin, then it's clearly not, doesn't have that attitude.
The problem that is changing now, right? I heard from Muslims, women don't dare to fail. They get commands from other Muslims during Ramadan when they eat during the day. It would have happened about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Well, you see it also in the Jews, among the Jews.
Yeah. Yes.
There is a movement to the right, and people are ragging. The term is the American term. They're complaining and ragging and digging other people who are doing it, who are not being good because they're not doing it right.
I wonder about this phrase here, and what has been offered up to other than God, which means a force of idolatry, I suppose.
Yes.
It does not mean, I take it, that you can only eat what has been offered to God.
Has been sacrificed.
The offered to what?
they're not talking about sacrifices that meant to be Muslim sacrifices.
No, no, they're not talking about sacrifices, but they do, and I think there's another verse in here that sort of supports this. They do, you say, the shochet, the Muslim shochet, says Bismillahirrahmanirrahim before he sacrifices the animal. So it's to God. It's in the name of God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the kavanah is that this is an Islamic practice.
So if the shochet for the shkita says it's bracha, that does not count.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. There are some Muslims that will say, well, it's preferable if you say Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. But there are others that will say, look, he said it, it's the same God. Jews are monotheists as opposed to Christians, which are really Safek monotheists.
Would it be your custom when they come into Western Europe that they would buy from the kosher butcher if there is no halal in the name?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Halal is preferable.
Yeah, you have to say for each animal that's being sold. And for Shkita, it's only once a day.
So they want to make sure that they don't get the first animal.
We'll see another text that we're going to come up against that will look like it's problematic, and we'll look at that though, a Quranic text that says something about Jewish and Christian foods.
Okay. Well, I was struck by the phrase and give thanks to God if this is needed in the universe.
Yeah.
Very
interesting.
Is it if?
Yeah, it does say that.
Is it like in Hebrew that can also be like an oath?
I think that my reading of this, and I may be reading it wrongly, it is if it is he whom you are worshiping, but I understand it as like saying, look, if you're really a believer, then that's what you need to do.
Okay.
I think that's what he's saying.
I'll say it is the Yuridina.
I don't think it's like saying, if you're a Muslim, you do it this way, but if you're not a Muslim, you do it that way. I think it's kind of like assuming that you say you're a Muslim, so you should follow through with it.
Yeah.
I think that's the meaning. Is that what's being said there?
So much. Yes.
Okay. So, how about then? Are we ready for the next one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fishing and food of the sea are permitted to you as a convenience for you and for travelers, but game from the land is forbidden to you as long as you remain in a state of sanctification. Be conscious of God to whom you will be gathered.
What means but game from the land?
Game is hunted food.
Hunted food.
Hunted
food. What does it mean, as long as you remain in a state of sanctification?
As long as you can't hunt if you have the ihram, like if you're going on Hajj, you can't hunt.
But if you're not in that state, then
you can eat game. Yeah, no problem with eating game.
Is that state of sanctification also like after prayer?
No.
Or is it just on?
Well, I don't, it says horma here, so... if you are in a state of sanctification, I don't. Churuman is the term. I don't know. In this context, maybe there were other states of sanctification in addition to the one for the Hajj, but I'm not familiar with them, so I'm assuming it's the Hajj state of sanctification.
You said something about like the washing. Hands and feet was a sanctification from, right? And that was the same thing, like if you touch a woman or you're sending a mission or whatever, and you also wash as a way of putting aside what was a clean becoming sanctified.
Right, but it's a different term that's used for that, so I think it's a different kind of sanctification. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming here, I'm not sure that I'm right. It might mean if you are in a sacred area, it's a haram, you're also in a state of sanctification. So whether you're on the pilgrimage or not.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mention with regard to the pilgrimage that there's only one time of the year that you can make the pilgrimage, and that's during the month called Dhul Hijjah, which is the Hajj month. And the actual pilgrimage is 10 days. It's really got to be grueling. It's 10 days of activities. That you do. Each day you do certain activities that are prescribed for that particular day that you need to do. and you go through the whole process with 2 million other people, because there are 2 million people.
Where do you start from?
Excuse me, you start from in Mecca.
Okay, you start from Mecca.
And then you leave, you go outside. Oh, you're always in the Haram area, because there's a big Haram area there, outside of Mecca as well.
You fly into Mecca International Airport?
I don't think so. I think you fly somewhere else and then go to Mecca. Mm-hmm. I don't think you fly. Or if you fly into the airport, it's got to be Haram, not outside the Haram area. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But people can actually take the oath of Haram before you even get into the Haram area. Once you started your pilgrimage, in Egypt, you can take your Haram oath.
Mm-hmm.
Your Haram oath and then. Because you're on your way.
But
the actual Hajj is only possible during those 10 days. You can do the same things, but you don't get Hajj credit for it mm-hmm. at any other time of year. And that's called the Umrah. Mm-hmm. It's not called Hajj. And so there is at least one state in there where it says Hajj or Umrah.
Right.
And so people will make the Umrah, especially if you have the means to do so, people do the Umrah maybe many times because you get a certain barakah, you know, a bracha. For doing that and being a part. And it's a statement of piety and sanctity. And there also aren't a million people. There are literally 2 million people doing the Hajj at the same time. And 2 million only because that's the maximum that the Saudi government will allow.
How many people die?
Every year?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. People die.
About people who get trampled.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some years we don't hear about anything. In other years you hear about things and it just... Yeah. I mean, I'm sure people, you know, people go to Varanasi, Benares, because they're dying and they want to go there to be dead. Because you get special blessing if you're there in India, in the holy city, if you die there. I'm sure that there are people who are not in good shape who also go on the Hajj, because it's a good thing if you're going to die, it's good to die on pilgrimage. But I don't know. I don't know whether that's true or not. That might be.
Jews die at home, but then they're transported to be buried in the mud.
Well, yeah, I mean, no. Some Jews end up being buried, and then they roll underground all the way.
Of course, yes, but that's
They're working that. Okay, so where are we? Surah 5? Or did we do that already?
No, we did.
Okay. Now, how about the B?
Yeah, that's interesting, because here's the difference between the Dutch and the English translation.
Eat from what God has provided you, that is lawful, halal, and wholesome, and give thanks for the favor of God. For you it is him you serve.
It must be for it is him. Let me just see.
For
you serve him, actually.
And the Dutch again comes back with the if. If it is him you serve.
Yeah.
What is the Arabic saying?
If it is him you serve.
Mm-hmm. God has forbidden you only dead things and blood and the flesh of pigs and anything offered up to something other than God. But if one is compelled by necessity without craving or being accepted, says it. For giving mercy, but do not assert the falsehood with your tongue, saying, "This is permissible and this is forbidden," to invent a lie against God. Those who invent a lie against God will not thrive. The brief enjoyments, but there is a painful penalty waiting for them. We forbade for the Jews what we have told you before. We did not oppress them, but they themselves transgressed.
Right. Now you'll see a lot of sort of a number of under.
They have themselves under Islam. They have transgressed against themselves. They've done injustice towards themselves.
Yeah. No. No, they themselves transgressed.
Yeah.
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 But I mean, you know, because it doesn't have that preposition, you'd have a preposition. I think they themselves transgressed, not against themselves. But in any case.
What does it mean?
Why
do
they.
Yeah.
How come they're all of a sudden into the game?
It also says we never wronged them, but they wronged themselves.
Okay.
Like with the out of harm, I'm getting to the Manishtana.
How does Haman get into the Manishtana? Why all of a sudden the Jews? In this
room. You don't know the expression?
I haven't heard of it.
How do you know get into the Manishtana?
How all of a sudden one thing one thing to do with the other?
I don't know about Muhammad and the
Rebbe. Maybe there's something else. Later.
Water.
No. I'm fine. Thank you. Yeah, the subtext for this is all the Jewish kashrut laws, yeah. And I'm assuming there's an argument going on here, right? And this is part of that conversation. Jews, somebody is saying, well, the Jews are doing it right, and somebody is saying the Jews are overdoing it. And God wouldn't make them eat these weird foods and prevent them from eating all these good, healthy, wholesome foods. And so they must be transgressing themselves, or it might be punishment for them because of their sins, because they didn't do what God really wants. I think there are a number of ways to understand it, but the oppressive sort of underlying problem for the Quranic kashrut laws is, why does the Quran do it this way when you already have it set out doing it a different way? So you kind of have to, so the burden is on the new way to justify it. Now, exactly what's going on, I don't know, but I'm assuming in all of these texts there's a sort of ongoing subtle argument.
The differences aren't that large, I think. So it's about freedom, and it's about not
game you can eat, we can't. It's quite a lot of things. It only mentions pig. We have a whole list of things.
Well, let's read some more text and then we can have this discussion. Let's get a little more data. You see, the burden is always on the more liberal to justify why they're not doing it as strictly as the others. The people who are more strict are more pious, right? So you can then say back to them, well, you're only strict because God is punishing you because you screwed up, not because God really wants you to do it this way. Right? Or there are other ways to respond to it too. These are all theoretical arguments. I assume that a lot of scriptural material, also in the Tanakh, is a response to an unvoiced polemic or argument between the people in the scripture, who are the good guys, and then the people who are criticizing them outside. So you can assume it's Canaanites or Philistines or Greeks or Arabs or Christians or Jews. And a lot of rabbinic literature, too, is a response to arguments against Jews and Judaism. As is commentaries, medieval commentaries, a lot of them are. It's just we don't have those arguments.
Well,
sometimes we do have the arguments. But
if you read the Jewish polemic against Christians in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and Christians are bad towards us. We're as bad back as.
I don't understand.
It's a very nasty Jewish polemic against the Christians during the late Middle Ages.
Nothing as bad as the Christian polemic against the Jews.
Have you read the Jewish one against the Christians?
The Sefer HaVikuchim?
There are several, yes.
Yeah.
They can be quite.
Those are reactive, and you also always have to think. By the way, I'm not trying to protect the Jews making nasty comments.
It was a discovery for me. It was a discovery for me when I had a student years ago who did the master and all that kind of thing. I just discovered what the wound was, you know.
But you see, in a Christian world, you have no holds barred. You can say anything you want. There's no one's going to threaten you. You can say things against the Jews because they're not going to attack you. And you can say things against the Muslims because they're on the other side of the lake, of the pond. Right? So they can say anything they want. But the Jews have to be very circumspect. So when Jews are saying something really nasty, the assumption is that it's really internal. Nobody's going to read it outside because they're endangering their lives by doing that. So more often than not, the Jewish anti-Christian and anti-Islamic polemic is in code. It's coded, not quite so obvious. So if it's really an obvious nasty polemic, there must be some interesting reason why that's happening.
That's on the subject.
Anyway.
You know, it's such a pity that, you know, the people we deal with today they don't read it. Well, they see it and they don't realize it's part of the discussion.
Of the polemic. They just think that's God saying that the Jews are screwing up or something like that. Yeah, because they don't contextualize it in the same way we do.
Right. So how do you face that?
And you can't really say that in a interreligious dialogue situation, right? That's true.
So the frustration of you was sitting it all understanding and nodding our head.
That's what we're doing tomorrow morning. How do you handle it in a damning situation?
Okay, so let's read the next one, Surah 3. Who's next to read?
I will.
Okay.
All food was permissible to the children of Israel, except that Israel forbade itself before the Torah was revealed. Say, bring the Torah and recite it if you are telling the truth. So if anyone fabricates a lie against God after that, they are wrongdoers.
That's sort of strange.
Very strange.
Yeah, it says, bring the Torah and recite it if you are telling the truth.
But then they say you screwed up. You bring the Torah and they say, as corrupted.
Yeah, because the assumption is that you're not bringing the real Torah. Bring the real Torah and tell us what it's really saying. I mean, it's an impossible accusation to respond to.
All the rabbinical rules they apply. You have the Torah and then you have whatever they made out of it.
Yes, so that may be. That's true. That may be saying something here. That the Torah doesn't have it as strict as this. And so bring the Torah. Where does it say in the Torah that you can't have cheese, milk and meat? Yeah. You know, when the... okay, doesn't matter. Okay, so Surah 5.
Forbidden to you is the death, the blood, and the flesh of pigs, and what has been offered to other than God. Death which has been strangled, beaten, or has fallen, has been gored or has been eaten by wild animals, except what you have come across, and what has been sacrificed on stone pillar, and what you have divined by means of divining arrows. This is an abomination.
Okay. So you're not allowed to eat the dead, the blood,
not
the
fat, except if you just fight. Is that what it says?
Yeah, but then the commentators add, if you found it and it was shechted properly, and you found it before it was dead completely, so it could be completely shechted. Doesn't seem to be that. That's not the pshat, but that's the understanding, right? So I don't know what the pshat would be for that. I don't know if anybody has figured that one out. But the last part is pretty clear. You know, what has been sacrificed on the stone pillar, assuming presumably to other gods, to gods, or divined by means of divining arrows. This is divination through the throwing of arrows. Was a very common pre-Islamic Arabian practice. What did the gods say? So there may have been a sacrifice associated with the divining arrows that are done in front of the gods. And there's a famous story about Muhammad's grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, who... do you want to hear the story? It's a nice story. It's an interesting story. It's actually a very interesting story. It's something I thought maybe I'd write about. His name was Abdul Muttalib, which means the slave of somebody, Al-Muttalib. I don't know what that means, actually. And he's the grandfather of Muhammad. And he lived in Mecca, and he discovered the Zamzam well. That's the well that God responded to in Hagar and Ishmael. But that well had sort of been stopped up. Had been stopped up, and in the pre-Islamic days, but it was also a place where lots of gold and silver and offerings were thrown into, like throwing coins in a fountain. Muhammad's grandfather Abdul Muttalib found the well. It had been stopped up. He discovered it, and he started digging in it, and he found all kinds of gold and things like that. And so everybody else in Mecca, in the Quraysh tribe, came to him and they said, we want that gold, we want that silver, so you have to give it to us. And he was being harassed and beaten, and he said, if only I had sons, if I had sons to protect me, O Hubal, who was the god of the Kaaba, this is in polytheism, right? If I had 10 sons, O Hubal, God of the Kaaba, to protect me, I would sacrifice one to you. And then, so he fought them off, and he lost his gold, and he eventually had 10 sons. And since he was an honest man, he had to sacrifice one of his sons to Huba, the god. So he tried to determine how to do that, and he was advised that he should do the divination with arrows. So he gave each of his 10 sons an arrow, and he had them throw the arrows in however way they do the divination. And it turned out that the arrow fell on, guess who? Muhammad's father, Abdullah. And so Abdul Muttalib took Abdullah and walked over to Hubal, drew his knife, and was going to slaughter him because he was an honest man and he fulfills his debts and his promises. And people in Mecca heard about this, and they said, "Are you crazy? You can't sacrifice your son. You don't sacrifice people. And if you start sacrificing people, everybody's going to start sacrificing people. That's not a good idea. So we're not going to let you do it." And he said, "But I have to do it because I promised Hubal I'd do it. And if I don't do it, I'm going to be in big trouble." And so they said, "Look, why don't you go to the witch of Ain Dor, the witch that lives in the village up the street, and ask her, because she has these familiar ghosts, these ghosts that she can consult, and to tell you how you might be able to satisfy the god Hubal without sacrificing your son." And so he said, "Okay, there's nothing to lose." Everybody agreed, nothing to lose. If she says, just sacrifice him, then you sacrifice him. If she says there's another way out, then maybe there's another way out. So they go to her, and she consults the spirits, and the spirits tell him that in order to resolve the problem, he has to do the following. He has to go back to the god, Hubal, with his son, and he has to bring the arrows, and you have to put your son on one side, and you have to bring 10 camels on the other side, and toss the arrows. And if the arrows fall to the side of the camels, then all you have to do is redeem him by sacrificing 10 camels to Hubal, and you don't have to sacrifice your son. But if it falls on your son, bring another 10 camels and try it again. So nothing to lose. So he did. So he brought the first 10 camels. It fell against his son. Then he brought 10 more camels, and they cast the arrows, and it fell against his son. And they did it until there were 100 camels, which is a huge amount of wealth. And everybody got all excited, and everyone was pitching in, and they got 100 camels, and finally, after 10 throws, it went to the side of the camels. And so he saved his son. But Abdul Muttalib wasn't finished yet, because he said, "Maybe it was just chance, and I don't want to get this god angry, because it's a bad idea." So he threw the arrows 2 more times, and each time it went to the camels. So he knew that he could redeem his son with the 100 camels. So they had a big party, they sacrificed 100 camels, and he redeemed him with 100 camels, and that was the great redemption. That's sort of a and he's called Abu Sada, the child of redemption was one of the names of his father Abdullah, and then from Abdullah, of course, came Muhammad. So this was a potent sign of something. Actually, so why I was interested in this narrative, I'm interested in the narrative. It's like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Mm-hmm. Abdul Muttalib is Abraham. Isaac is Muhammad's father, and the father of the Arab peoples, of the Muslim Arab peoples, the Jacob figure, the Israel figure, is Muhammad.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool? Again, it's sort of using this paradigm. There's a question of whether there is a borrowing of images, or whether this is just a kind of human, universal notion of sacrifice and redemption and the building up of the people.
That's so God provides.
Where is it?
It's found in the Sirah, which is the prophetic biography of Muhammad. It's an early story that occurs, of course, long before Muhammad was born.
If you haven't heard the news, but Obama was in Ireland.
Yes.
Visiting his great grandfather.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that funny?
Same audience.
But even more interesting, you know, another added piece of that is, remember, what's Isaac's role? Basically, no role. He basically is not there. Same with Abdullah. Muhammad's father has no role. He dies before Muhammad is born. He really has no role in the narrative. It's Abdul Muttalib, the grandfather, Abraham, and then the grandson, becomes the progenitor of the
sacrifice is basically dumb anyway. It doesn't has a sound. That's the role of a sacrifice anyway.
Well,
right, so it's almost as if he was sacrificed. Yeah, and it's the same sacrifice.
I mean,
yeah.
And that's, sometimes I think that people are so irritated when Jews start talking about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Because we're supposed to be sacrificed. We're supposed to
right.
be keep our mouth shut.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, I don't come from that. I don't hear that word in my ear.
No.
My
but I mean, here in this area, you shouldn't talk about too much about it because,
The Jews say that or the non-Jews?
No, non-Jews.
Non-Jews.
Say that. No, we don't consider ourselves a sacrifice.
Right. No.
No, I don't think the Jews do.
Okay, onward. So then, Surah 6, the cattle. One line.
Do not eat anything over which the name of God, is Allah, has not been invoked, for it is an abomination.
What does it mean? It has not been invoked.
We have to say
baracha.
Yeah. And it is lam yuzakir, yuzakir. This, this kor Hashem ha'el, yiparach.
So the kosher butcher again.
So to those who are Judaized, inna aladina hadu. Those again, remember I talked about that the other day. Those are Judaized. Okay, so we have a. You want to read that, right?
To those who are Judaized, we have forbidden everything with claws, and of the oxen and flocks, we have forbidden the fat, except what they carry on their backs for intestines, or what is mixed with the bone. This we repay them for their iniquity. For we are truthful. I don't understand.
Okay. Yeah, this is a really good one. I don't know why I didn't choose. For some, I missed this one that I wanted to say. Anyway. Those were Judaized, okay, so we know who they are. We, God speaking, we have forbidden everything with claws. It looks like it has something to do with Fris Parsa or something like that, right? Something about hooves or claws. But they didn't, it's not. The way we see it, not at all, not right. Or we've forbidden everything with claws. Those are carnivorous animals,
yeah,
as opposed to and
also the birds.
Oh yes, maybe yes, yeah. And then we also have the chelev,
yeah,
right. And intestines, what's mixed with the bone? Bone is. Azam is etzem.
But it says that they are forbidden the chalef, except what is in the intestines. Whereas with us, it's the other way around.
Yeah. I don't know if they weren't reading the Torah to get this information.
Yeah.
So there's some association with fats or something like that.
He translates here on him, he had yodin on him. It's interesting, the problem being quite Judaized. He says these, those who follow Judaism.
Okay.
Fingers.
It would be, the Hebrew would be Ele Asher Hit Yahadu. That would be the term. That's exactly the translation.
Sorry?
Ele Asher Hit Yahadu. Those who have Judaized. All right.
You said the Jews.
Yeah. Well, because that ends up being the Jews, but it is a different term and it's used beyond the week. The one verse that I did not include in here, I don't know why it fell out of this, was a verse that says, I'll paraphrase it, and I don't recall, I read it from the text, but I don't recall which verse, chapter and verse, but it says, the food of the Jews and the Christians is permitted to you, just as your food is permitted to them. And the women of the Jews and Christians are permitted to you. And then it says something else. It doesn't say the men, and it doesn't say your women are permitted to them. So the food is reciprocal, which doesn't make sense, right? Because Christian food theoretically would not be permitted to Muslims because they're eating chazer. And that becomes the basis for the ruling in Islam that Muslim men can marry Jewish and Christian women, but Muslim women cannot marry Jewish or Christian men. That becomes then quoted in the Sharia. And when Muslim men marry Jewish or Christian women, if the Jewish and Christian women want to practice their religion and go to church or go to synagogue, they must be allowed to do that without being impeded. But the children have to grow up as Muslims because Islam is passed through the male line rather than through the female line, according to Islamic legal traditions.
But that's not in the Quran.
The identity issue?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's derived from this verse from the Quran. Yeah, the Quran doesn't say that specifically. So if you're a child of a Jewish mother and a Muslim father, you're a Jislim or a Mu.
Mew.
Mew, right.
The food to those to whom the book was given is lawful to you and yours to them. 5:5.
Oh, good. You have a good index there, don't you? Yeah. Isn't that good? Okay, so keep going.
Lawful to you are the believing women and free women from among those who were given the book before you, provided that you give them their dowries and live in honor with them, neither committing fornication nor taking them as mistresses. Not quite sure what you mean. He that denies the faith shall gain nothing from his labor. What is something else?
Yeah. That probably means there has to be a legal marriage of some sort. You can't just...
It only says that the believing women and the free women from among those who were given the book before you are permitted to.
Mm-hmm. Well, heathens and yearlings, the whole thing is lost down. Het voedsel van hen aan wie het boek gegeven is, is aan jullie toegestaan. Jullie voedsel is aan hen toegestaan op de eerbare vrouwen onder de gelovigen en de eerbare vrouwen van hen aan wie voor jullie tijd het boek gegeven is. Als jullie haar in eerbaarheid en niet in ontucht haar loon geeft, een zonder minnaressen te nemen.
Geheime minnaressen staat hier.
Ja?
Zonder. Here it says taking them as mistresses
well,
and not having other mistresses.
Yeah, what is this idea of the way it's in fact it's prostitution, but you have this marriage for the moment. Yeah.
That's Shia. And it's as long as you make a tanai before the wedding, before the marriage. Marriage in Islam is a contract only. There's no tekis, really. No ritual in marriage. The marriage rituals that we all see with dancing horses and strange things and people, the groom riding on a horse and the woman being brought in and all that, that's all cultural. That's a kind of Arab cultural thing, not an Islamic religious thing. They don't have the thing of, kesef, biyah, and shtar. They just have a shtar, basically the contract. And so you can, as long as you have a contract that is agreed upon between the woman and the man before the marriage, and since divorce is allowed, and you include in the contract that there will be a divorce in 8 hours after the consummation of the marriage, or 4 hours or whatever it will be, and it's agreed upon by both parties and it's acceptable.
Okay. That's two before two witnesses?
The wedding, the marriage, the contract, not the dia.
If you have another man going there.
Right. Yes, but
And the woman goes on as a divorcee.
She goes out as a divorcee, but she can make a lot of money.
Okay.
You know.
That's worth it.
Right. And you can divorce multiple times, and you can divorce someone, and then the person can come back. As in Jewish law, you can't do that. So, right. But not immediately. I think actually, I don't remember.
6 hours?
No. I think it's
nice.
The Viagra works quicker.
So here's something interesting. There are cases in the Shiite world where young man and a woman who are not romantically engaged at all want to share an apartment together and go to the university. And so they get married officially, and they have in the contract that they're going to be sharing the apartment together, and they set up all the rules in the contract, and they can live together even though they have they don't actually have sexual relations. They're not in love, they don't have relations with one another, but they're not going to be killed for living together out of wedlock in a traditional Muslim society because they're married officially. Even though everybody knows that they're not going to have sex together, or assumes they're not going to have sex together. If they did have sex, it would be okay too, because they're actually married, but they're not interested. And that was not an uncommon act, apparently, at certain times in history. And I don't know if that means pre-end of the Shah period or after the Shah period, but I learned that that was an option as well in the Shia world. As a way to kind of deal, in a way that's kind of an advanced, a kind of a progressive thing. You've got a rule, you've got a religious rule, and you can deal with the rule in a way where you can live like a normal college student. You could share an apartment.
It's a bit like this film. I forgot the name. This Jewish doctor and his brother's widow, and is going to be a chalitza, but he can't do it. And they have a marriage. They decide to get married, but live as roommates.
Mm. Oh, really? Why can't he do the chalitza? He just can't bring himself there.
Because he's not
religious.
He's not religious at all. But he loved his brother very much, and then
his brother's religious.
His brother was religious, and this woman reminds him of his brother.
Mm.
So he feels the love
he
had for his brother somehow. That is what connects.
Of course, he had a child there. Where did she get a child from? What it was all about?
Everything.
Not necessarily.
Everything.
That's what they say. Yes. But if she's beyond the age,
it's a love story eventually,
it's
right?
A love story. And of course, her family is older. Her mother is
Hollywood. Hollywood.
They pretend that they're sharing a bedroom, but they're really not.
I see.
I think it's starting to slow down.
Can I answer? Yes.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Yeah.
Is there a negative connotation in Islam about divorce? Just sort of.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people. I think it depends on where you are. I think in the West there is a negative connotation because it's picked up from the culture at hand. I was just reading, I'm trying to remember where I was reading it, about, if you look at Bin Laden, did you see how many women he was married to and divorced and had all these women, and then his assistants and people that were like married multiple times. First of all, they could have four at one time, but they would divorce and have another, and then they'd have it. So that they ended up having, one man would have relations with a dozen women altogether in their lives through divorce and taking more than one as wives at the same time. So, and that's assumed to be a traditional deal. So, I think in that kind of context it probably it wasn't an issue. And women were not disparaged for being divorced. They also often got remarried and didn't have trouble getting remarried.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm telling you now is all theoretical. I don't know if it would be different in Sudan than it would be in Morocco, than it would be in Indonesia. I'm sure that there'd be big differences between them. I'm sure there must be some places where it's hard for a woman to be remarried after a divorce. Yeah. But I do know, however, that it is not, at least in the westernized Muslim world, and I don't mean in the West, but in places like Cairo and Damascus and places like that, there is sometimes, there is a lot of resentment directed toward men that take more than one wife.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my two oldest Muslim friends are Palestinian, and they were all pretty well westernized. And one of them, after 25 years or so, or 30 years, took a new wife, a young thing, and he had like 10 or 11 children with his first wife, and everyone was really angry with him, but certainly his kids and his wife, his first wife, were really angry, and he said, they'll get used to it, it'll pass, and it'll be okay, but you know, it's hard at the beginning, but it'll be okay. But a lot of people really criticized him for that, because it wasn't a good thing. It would have been terrible to divorce his first wife, but he it also would be terrible to take a younger wife and have relations with the younger wife and maybe not have relations with the first wife, although by law you're obligated to.
That's what happens in the West all the time, that they take the younger wife and then
Avenue Modi.
Yeah. Okay. So it's just not. It's not formalized.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So tomorrow we get to talk about war.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll talk about war.
And.